on the Paris Opera stage. And he then teamed up, well, his sort of protege was Adolphe Adam, who is the composer mainly known for Giselle, but who actually really taught him the craft, because he was a composer of 53 operas and 10 mostly forgotten ballets except for Giselle. And he got Delibes a job on the as a repetiteur in a minor opera comique place, really light opera. And then this word we've been coming on, comique, is a very important one, because the ballet comique de la Reine isn't funny. And there was the story of an Englishman who went to the opera comique who didn't speak a word of French but didn't want to let anybody know. And so every now and again he guffawed. And there weren't actually any jokes. It was a very serious opera comique. I mean, Bizet's Carmen is not a bundle of laughs, really. So that word comique has to be stressed, I think.
You must mention Delibes' comic operas that he did write.
The
again,
stories of these things became more and more ridiculous. One was about the cooking of an omelette with all kinds of ashes in it and tobacco and various other things, which were served some guests who wolfed it up and said it was lovely.
At this point, opera wanted in Paris ballet in it, didn't it? It was inconceivable that you could do an opera in Paris without having a dance section to it.
Absolutely. And I think this is one of the things that was very sort of characteristic of the French opera, was that you really had to incorporate a dance scene. And a dance scene means, you know, something like 20 minutes of dance. So what we would think of as a one-act ballet, and they were really integral to it. And if you were a composer whose work had gone on elsewhere, so for example, Verdi, he would rewrite his operas for Paris and incorporate the ballet scenes. So it was something that was terribly important. And if you didn't have your opera with a ballet, you would have to add a ballet at the end of the evening.
And no one was exempt. Tannhäuser had a ballet put in.
Well, when it went on, it didn't, and that caused a great deal of problem. So there are rare occasions. But likewise, you didn't go to an evening of ballet, as people expect to do now. You wouldn't just go and see even Coppelia. You would always have another work with it, which would be an opera or a scene from an opera. The idea of a full evening of dance was just horrible.
But the other way around, it meant there was plenty of work for dancers in Paris.
There was an enormous amount of work for dancers in Paris, because not only were they performing at the opera, but there were a lot of popular theatres that incorporated ballet. So within the popular fairy, the sort of fairy tale pantomime productions that were going on, in the music halls there were ballets as well. So actually there were probably more dancers being employed in Paris at that point than there have been sort of before or since.
And was there a crossover between what the dancers were doing, or was there a sort of snobbery that, you know, a certain level was at the opera and then another level was doing the more popular stuff?
I think there is a certain snobbery. So, yes, to be at the Paris Opera was the ultimate. But having said that, there are choreographers who briefly work at the opera and probably were earning good money elsewhere, and why shouldn't they go off and earn good money? Some of the dancers would choose to move from the Paris Opera to the Opera Comique to the music hall. So there was, I think, much more sort of flow. And, of course, there were dancers from abroad who were incorporated into the Paris Opera. They weren't exclusively dancers that they had trained.
We're hearing an authentic instrument performance of all of the works in this concert this evening. So you might, Richard, want to say a bit about how that relates to Coppelia. Horns, I know, are particularly interesting.
Well, the orchestra for Coppelia had completely changed from Rameau. I think three things probably had happened. One was the growth of the wind section and brass section, and the horns in particular, which were not as modern as the horns in the Rite of Spring, where you have valves, and they had to be played either by altering the crooks so that a horn player would come in with several crooks on his arm and change the plumbing, as it were, on the instrument, but also put his fist up the bell, which is how you actually got the two scales enabling you to play chromatic music. And when you do that, you get a very different tone on the stop notes. So that is one thing. There's also the introduction of the instrument, the ophicleide, which is in the Coppelia score and will be heard this evening. And
which is what?
An ophicleide is a large instrument, I think blown like a horn. It's a mouthpiece, not a reed. And also the other instruments, which are very important, are the cornet à piston, which is the little trumpets that were still in use at the time up to the 1880s, really, which make a much thinner sound than the modern trumpet. So the wind sound, the sound of the wind section, and this is true for the Rite of Spring as well, is very, very different from how it was going to be today.
Well, let's talk about the Rite of Spring and those famous events of over a century ago. We're promised this evening a recreation of the score as heard at its 1913 premiere, presumably without the shouting and other noises off from the audience, although who knows. This is going to be rather exciting, isn't it?
It's going to be very exciting. I mean, the other thing is, of course, that Stravinsky makes the... We can talk about the instruments, but really it's the people who play them and how you play them, right from Lully all the way through, because you can now take five or six different performances of music on authentic instruments and they all sound quite different. But the Rite of Spring, certainly, I've never heard it before on these instruments, which have crept forward. You can hear Schumann, you can hear, I think, some Wagner, so-called authentic instruments. And I still think the most important thing is the different sound of the wind. But when you get to Stravinsky, he is making people play higher in the register than they have before. He's making them use harmonics on the violins, playing glissando on harmonics, and all kinds of techniques which really were asking beyond the bounds of what the players could do. Isn't that the same thing with the choreography, in a sense, that Nijinsky asked people to do things sort of out of their comfort zone?
Oh, absolutely. The dancers were absolutely horrified at having to do things that were totally away from their training, indeed inverted their training in many senses. So I think that, yes, it is that sense of really sort of breaking away. I think we must remember that, I mean, we are talking about Paris, and one of the things that's really, I think, fascinating about tonight's concert is the opportunity to hear the music. So we've actually got this sense of evolution. So often we're getting accounts that say, of course, this is a big change from sort of Tchaikovsky and The Sleeping Beauty. Well, for the Parisian audiences, it was still ballets like Coppelia that they were used to. And so it's that is being sort of turned on its head.
Because Tchaikovsky ballets weren't done in Paris?
They weren't being performed in Paris at that point. So it's before we tend to sort of have written history on a universal basis rather than a local basis, so that we don't get a real sense of evolution. It's something that's really rather bizarre. But having said that, I think what was sort of happening with The Rite of Spring was that the ideas for the production certainly came from both the designer Rurik and Stravinsky, and Nijinsky, who choreographed it, comes in very much at the last moment. It's only the year before that he starts to choreograph in terms of main works for the Ballet Russe, and so he is something of a novelty. But he was somebody who was prepared to go completely outside the dancer's comfort zone in everything he did.
Had Paris, by the start of the 20th century, lost a bit of its gloss as world ballet capital? Had some of that gone to St. Petersburg?
Well, I think undoubtedly that there was a real interest in what was happening in St. Petersburg in particular. I think that was... And, it's, you know, reports of dance in the Imperial Ballet were filtering out, so there was an awareness that there was something happening. Having said that, there were still major productions going on in Paris. I think they had become fairly routine, rather less innovative than they had been. So it wasn't a sense that they were moving forward, it was a sense that they were marking time.
So does France have fair claim on the Rite of Spring as being a French ballet, or is it really a Russian ballet?
Oh, it's a Russian ballet, definitely a Russian ballet.
It just happened to have been
premiered in France. But I think it's also quite interesting that, of course, Parisian audiences do like novelties, and I think that's still true today.
And no shortage, Richard, of Russianness in the music.
The Rite of Spring, I think we're only really now beginning to understand it, in the sense that it is absolutely packed full of Russian wedding songs from various collections, because when it was written, 1909 was the period when we had our equivalent in England, but there was a huge force in many countries to revive folk music, to some extent through the evolution of the phonograph, and to some extent by absolutely avid collectors going around and finding tunes. And the tunes in the Rite of Spring, the melodies that he uses, very simple very often in shape, are actually taken from a book with something like 1,700 Lithuanian wedding songs, which have been found by a recent biographer of Stravinsky, unearthing this whole thing that you were mentioning, Rurik. lyric and the primitive ballet. The idea was somehow that refined art had lost its honesty and purity and that it had to be revived by that.
Yes, I think one must remember that just as Stravinsky is mining the folk tunes and everything, so Rurik was somebody who was absolutely fascinated by Russian history. It's very much the equivalent of, in a way, of our arts and crafts, almost sort of recreating a Russian folk art that was happening at the end of the 19th and early 20th century. And he's building on that. He's also fascinated by archaeology, so there are those elements that go in. So he's drawing on the past. And I think this is one of the things that's very exciting with The Writer's Spring, because here is the work. It's absolutely typical of what modernism is about, that really is based on the past, but is reinterpreted and represented for audiences, for contemporary audiences, and in a way that excites them and, to a certain extent, also shocks them.
It's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you both very much indeed for being with us this evening, Jane Pritchard and Richard Langham Smith.
And that was Petra Trelawney presenting our 20 Minutes feature. Tomorrow's is hosted by Rana Mitter. It's a Proms literary event talking about Mahler's letters. So welcome back live to the Royal Albert Hall for this Sunday night prom. On Bastille Day, the French have invaded the Royal Albert Hall, and there are many more of them than there were before. The stage is really swollen to full capacity. Over 100 players of Les Siècles, directed by François-Xavier Roth, who formed them 10 years ago. And of course, as we know, we're about to hear The Rite of Spring by Stravinsky, which 100 years ago caused such a storm in Paris. One of the most famous things about this is the opening, a bassoon solo, incredibly fragile and incredibly difficult to play. At least it was then. Nowadays, bassoonists have really got it under their fingers, but the instrument we're going to hear it played on now makes it a whole lot harder. I asked François-Xavier Roth about this particular bassoon we're going to hear.
French bassoon, le basson français. Now, sadly, the French bassoon almost disappeared. You know, I'm so glad that we bring this orchestra today, because the 20th century, in a way, was amazing. I'm not a nostalgic person. I love our time. But what I miss is the particularity of every orchestra. For example, in Paris, at the time of Le Sacre du Printemps, you could find 10, 15 different flute makers. In Paris, today, in the whole world, all the flutists of the world play on 5 different flute makers. It says a lot. The globalization of the instruments, and today, to go back to your question, all the bassoon of the world are German system, which is very fine. It's another instrument, but it's not at all the instrument that Stravinsky had in his ears. He thought of le basson français with this, and all this beginning, not only the bassoon, or the first part of Le Sac, is really a tribute to the woodwinds in their brilliancy, in their characterization. Is because Stravinsky did discover the French players with Le Firebird. And it was for him a long process till the Sacre du Printemps with his instruments in his ears.
François-Xavier Roth, and what is so wonderful about hearing the Rite of Spring on these instruments as they would have been played in 1913 by the original performers of the Rite of Spring is that Stravinsky's orchestration is so precise, so wonderfully coloured. The bassoon solo, for example, is that much more fragile because it's played on this instrument. In fact, there's a fragility about a great deal of the woodwind. On the other hand, the brass, it's easier, according to a trumpeter I spoke to earlier, to play a lot of this music on the trumpet of the period than it is to make a really loud sound on a modern trumpet. So what you'll hear is a sort of rebalancing of the orchestra if you're used to hearing this piece of music played on contemporary instruments. And it's thanks to the publishers Boosey and Hawkes who've given special permission for this particular edition to be used. There are a few little tweaks and changes which Stravinsky made to the very original performing score, which became the official performing score much later on, which absolutely everybody uses now. So this really is a quite extraordinary occasion here in the Royal Albert Hall, live on Radio 3, to be hearing a recreation of the original version from 1913 of The Rite of Spring. And it's the perfect place to conclude this survey of 4 centuries of French ballet music, beginning with Lully and Rameau, moving through Massenet and Delibes, and finally ending up with the Ballet Russe. Tonight's conductor, founder of the orchestra Les Siècles, which are 10 years old, François Xavier wrote bringing his players to their feet and taking the applause of the full Royal Albert Hall. This is Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring, Le Sacre du Printemps.
Thank you.
Well, like many of you listening, I'm sure you've heard that piece several times. I have, but I don't think I've ever heard such a nail-biting edge-of-your-seat performance of Stravinsky's groundbreaking 1913 ballet, The Rite of Spring. Live here at the BBC Proms at the Royal Albert Hall, we just heard the first ever performance in the UK of that recreation of the score exactly as it was heard at the revolutionary 1913 premiere of The Rite of Spring, the Sacre du Printemps. Thanks to conductor François-Xavier Rote and his period instrument ensemble, Les Siècles. That round of applause was for the principal bassoonist, Michael Roland, who played that exquisite solo right at the beginning on a French bassoon, which is almost never heard today. That's the 20-strong brass section on their feet, five percussionists, and the strings, 100 players exactly on stage, including François-Xavier Rote, Les Siècles' leader tonight, François-Marie Drieux. So wonderful to hear this music performed on instruments of the time. The brass in that final sacrificial dance as a girl dances herself to death in a pagan ritual is just that more biting and bright and energized. And the woodwind just that much more fragile. Something so spectacular about hearing it. François-Xavier Rote prepared our ears as best he could for that. I suppose in a way we were an authentic audience. We'd heard French dance music through the eras, from Lully and Rameau to Massenet and Delibes. But I suppose it just goes to show that nothing can prepare you for The Rite of Spring. The whole of the orchestra, Les Siècles, turning around now to bow to all of those sitting behind them on either side of the organ. This is the fourth performance they've given of this extraordinary program. It started in Paris, of course, and here they are now in London. They're touring, supported by the Institut Français. They want him back. Here he is, François-Xavier Rote, making his way back on stage. Shaking the hand of the leader, François-Marie Drieux, bringing each section one by one to their feet. The 2013 prom started on Friday. This is prom number four. Leaves me wondering, where on earth do we go from here? Well, the first place we go tomorrow is to Cadogan Hall at 1 o'clock in the afternoon for the first of the Proms chamber music concerts with the violinist Wilde Frang, who's also picked three pieces of music for Radio 3 listeners to hear tomorrow. You can hear them in Breakfast, Essential Classics, and In Tune. And then in the evening, we're joining the Arditti Quartet and Bamberg Symphony Orchestra and Jonathan Knott for Lachenmann and Mahler. And now, as the applause continues here in South Kensington at the Royal Albert Hall, I'll hand you on to Ian Skelly in Broadcasting House.
Sarah, thank you very much indeed. Sarah Moore-Peach at a very lively Royal Albert Hall tonight. Well, there are plenty more opportunities to hear that prom concert. If you came in at the very end of it, you can certainly listen again anytime you'd like to over the next 7 days by going to the Radio 3 website and then navigating your way to the listen again options on the iPlayer radio. Or if you prefer, you can hear the entire prom again when we rebroadcast tonight's programme on Wednesday afternoon here on Radio 3. You can hear a BBC prom every afternoon throughout the season. Tomorrow afternoon, for instance, we begin the week with a chance to hear the first prom of the season. Music by Rachmaninoff and Vaughan Williams dominated the evening on Friday. A spectacular performance of Rachmaninoff's variations on a theme by Paganini. It was played by Stephen Huff. And then over 500 voices filled the Albert Hall in a performance of Vaughan Williams's first symphony, the Sea Symphony. The BBC Symphony Orchestra was conducted by Zachary Oramo on Friday, and you can hear it all at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon here on the home of the BBC Proms, BBC Radio 3.
Mozart, Rachmaninoff, and an all-Verdi anniversary programme at the BBC Proms. Two concerts from Sir Antonio Pappano and the Orchestra of the Academy of Santa Cecilia. The ceremonial fizz and pomp of Mozart's Haffner Symphony and the melancholy and high drama of Rachmaninoff's Symphony No. 2 on Friday night, and a celebration of the bicentenary of Giuseppe Verdi on Saturday. Two BBC Proms concerts with Sir Antonio Pappano, starting Friday night at 6:30 on BBC Radio 3.
I have Mozart for you next tonight, but stay tuned if you can for a session by a member of the Radio 3 New Generation Artist Scheme in this week's edition of Jazz Lineup later. The jazz saxophonist Trish Clowes bringing her jazz quintet to the studio for a session that begins at 11:30 tonight. And before it, you can hear what something called Panzori sounds like. It's a form of musical drama from Korea, and Radio 3's microphones were at the K-Music 2013 festival last month to record it for the programme. The programme is World Roots, and it begins tonight in just under 20 minutes' time at 10 o'clock. But yes, Mozart, as Sarah was mentioning there, tomorrow, live from the Proms Chamber recital series at 1 o'clock, you can hear Wilde Frang playing a violin sonata by Mozart, the one in G, Kirchhoff 379. Well, here to whet your appetite now is one in F, and it's played by a fortepianist, Jos von Immerseel, and the violinist Midori Zeiler. The violinist Midori Zeiler and the fortepianist Jos von Immerseel playing Violin Sonata by Mozart, the one in F major, Kochel 377. And tomorrow on Radio 3 you can hear another close neighbour of that piece, the one in G, Kochel 379. This time a modern piano will take to the stage at Cadogan Hall in London, along with the violin belonging to Wilde Frang. The pianist will be Michael Liefitz. And as well as the Mozart, you can hear them playing the sonata by Ravel and music by Lutosławski, one of his partitas. That's launching this year's Proms Chamber Music Recital series, and it's all live here on Radio 3 tomorrow lunchtime at 1 o'clock. And, by the way, you'll be able to see that performance once it's been given. It'll appear on the Proms website, where you can also see what's so far been filmed or televised of the BBC Proms at the Royal Albert Hall. The first night, for example, and also parts of last night's prom, which played to a full two-capacity audience, the Doctor Who prom, all manner of surprise and guest appearances. bbc.co.uk/proms for video, online, and much, much more besides. Well, guests tomorrow night at the Proms will be the Bamberg Symphony Orchestra and a string quartet, the Arditti Quartet. String quartet and orchestra combining to give the UK premiere of a new piece by Helmut Lechenmann, Musik Konkret, never before heard at the Proms. And after that, one of Mahler's most popular symphonies, his Fifth Symphony, composed in the very first years of the 20th century with that famous Adagietto by his love letter to his wife Alma. We're live at the Royal Albert Hall tomorrow at 7:30. Hope you can join us. Time now on Radio 3, though, for World Roots with Lucy Duran.
Tonight we're at Cadogan Hall in London for a night devoted to Korean traditional music. It's all part of a week-long festival of visiting Korean artists. And tonight, the highlight is Pansori, traditional Korean musical drama performed by the acclaimed singer An Suk-sun. We'll also hear a piece from the so-called Important Intangible Cultural Heritage No. 23, as designated by the Korean government. A virtuoso pansori song accompanied on the kayagum, the Korean 12-string zither. I'll be talking to An Suk-sun later on, but now I'm joined for the evening by the traditional Korean flautist and music researcher, Hyerim Kim. Hyerim, give us an idea of what we're going to be hearing tonight.
Well, Korean music has a very long history, dating back 5,000 years, when shamanistic song and dance were part of the Asian society. And a royal court music developed in the 14th century during the Joseon dynasty. Actually, at the time, different kinds of music were played depending on what kind of places and people were performing. Along with the court music, there was another kind of music performed among common people.
And is that what we're going to be hearing tonight?
Yes. This music is for folk people, common people. Tonight we'll hear folk music of Korea, more specifically pansori.
And so pansori is a folk music, but it's sometimes described as opera. It's not opera?
It's all done by one singer, even though it's accompanied by one drummer, but it's very simple form of singing. So it can't be said pansori is an opera.
But it is a kind of a musical drama. A story is told.
Pansori tells a lot of interesting stories from old Korea. The epic storytelling, the pansori, has a wide spectrum of tone colors, including harsh sounds and variety of ornaments to express that kind of dynamics of a Korean history.
How unusual is it to hear pansori performed outside Korea?
An Suk-sun, the pansori singer we're going to hear tonight, she's the most acclaimed singer in Korea. It is even hard to see her in Korea.
Really?
Yes.
So we're in for a very, very special treat.
Yes, of course.
So first of all, we're going to be hearing something on an instrument called the komungo.
Yes. The komungo is a zither on which six silk strings are stretched over a soundboard made of wood. And the second, third, and fourth strings are on 16 frets, while the rest of strings are supported by movable bridges. And most significant thing about this instrument is that the strings are struck by a pencil-like stick. This motion gives a very sharp percussive attack to each note.
So here, from Cadogan Hall in London, this is Choi Young-hun on the komungo, the zither, playing a sanjo, or a solo improvisation. Thank you. That was a solo improvisation by Choe Young-hoon on the komungo, the Korean fretted zither. And she was accompanied on the chango, the double-headed drum, by Choe Young-soo. And that solo improvisational style is known as sanjo. So I'm told by our musical expert, the researcher and flautist, Hyerim Kim, who's here with me this evening to explain about Korean music. I'm very grateful to you, Hyerim, for joining us. The next piece of music that we're going to be hearing has a rather grand title of Important Intangible Cultural Heritage Number 23. I think that's what I like most about it, that it's number 23. So does that mean that there are lots of important intangible cultural heritages in Korea?
Yes. So far, 119 have been designated by the Korean government. Since the scheme began in 1962, this and a similar scheme in Japan was influential in UNESCO, setting up their list of intangible cultural heritage.
So it predates UNESCO. UNESCO took the idea from Korea.
Yes, it was modeled based on this kind of a preservation system.
What is it that makes a piece of music or a genre qualify to become designated as intangible cultural heritage?
First of all, I think the aesthetic value of the old heritage has been really important. And secondly, many of them has been in danger, so it's kind of extinct. So government noticed that it has to be preserved by law.
So these 119 pieces are actually enforced by law to be preserved.
So it's got some extra support, financial support from the government. It encourages young generations of a musician to keep this valuable heritage.
I mean, you yourself, for instance, Hyerim, you're a flautist. Have you benefited from this scheme of intangible cultural heritage in Korea?
Of course. Due to this kind of a preservation system, we've got more chances to perform these artistic forms, and we can more easily access the archived forms of this disappearing music.
And now, with this scheme, are these forms of music, are these 119 forms, are they actually doing well? Are they flourishing?
This is kind of a dilemma because of this kind of preservation system tried to keep intact instead of encouraging more creative ideas out of the tradition. So it is hard to create something new out of it. So it's kind of a contradictory facts.
Well, then what we're next going to hear is something which is called Kayagum Pyeongchang.
Yes. Kayagum is the instrument and Pyeongchang is the form of a musical genre. Kayagum is a 12-string zither. It's played with the fingers and it's considered a less aggressive sound than the komungo.
The instrument that we just heard.
Yes.
And so when you say it's played with the fingers, that means it doesn't have that percussive sound of the komungo.
No, we deliberately use the bare fingers because it creates more warmer and intimate sounds than the percussive fretted zither, the komungo.
And am I right in thinking that the kayagum is Korea's best-known instrument?
Yes, that's true. If you learn the notation of a kayagum, you can read most of the other notation for the other instruments. So it's a kind of a basic learning process for all of a traditional music learner.
And we are now going to hear the great singer An Suk-sun performing the kayagum. Is she going to sing as well?
Yes, this is all about kayagum Pyeongchang. This is a form of presented by one singer who is playing the kayagum at the same time.
Kutteyo, 도련님과 준양이 사랑가로 한번 놀아보는 디 사랑 사랑 내 사랑이야 오 둥둥 네가 내 사랑이야 이리 보아도 내 사랑 저리 보아도 내 사랑 우리 둘이 사랑 다가
불길하게 죽는단 말씀은 왜 하시오? 그러면 정담을 하랴? 정자 노래를 들어라. 정자 노래를 들어라. 너와 나와 유정헌이 어찌 아니다 정하리. 정담 장강소 성성언니 암수의 원남정 송남불승정 함남태수인구정 삼태역병원 백과